This is Israeli Technology Founders Speak, a podcast of conversations with successful Israeli high-tech and biotech entrepreneurs, with your host, Avraham Hermon. Dr. Hadas Shatz Azulai is the co-founder of MindTension, an Israeli biotech startup that has created a device which allows for accurate measuring of ADHD, which helps in diagnosis and proper drug prescription. Avraham sat down with Dr. Azulai in the Modi'in offices of JMB Davis Ben David to discuss how she became involved in the startup, getting funded, the challenges of being a woman co-founder, tips for startup founders, and much more. This podcast is a creation of JMB Davis Ben David, an intellectual property law firm serving clients around the world. You have great innovations. We keep them safe. It's not enough to just have a great startup idea or innovation. If you don't legally protect your innovations, products, and brand, anyone can claim them as their own. We keep your great innovation secure. Learn more by going to jmbdavis.com. That's jmbdavis.com.
Good morning. Welcome, Dr. Hadas Shatz Azulai.
Hi.
And thank you for coming to our office here in Modi'in.
It's a pleasure.
You're the COO of MindTension. It's a company that I just learned about recently at a convention. So let's start with talking about what problem MindTension solves.
So MindTension started as a company focused on measuring attention, but it's much more than that. What we're actually doing, we're measuring starter response, which is a reflexive response of your brainstem to stimuli, and we're measuring it with auditory stimuli. And actually what we get is an insight into the mental status and the neurological status of a person, because this startle response has a lot of literature about the correlation between it to different mental and neurological disorders and problems. And this is something that solves a huge problem, because in this world, especially in attention, but other mental health issues as well as PTSD or depression or anxiety, most of the way to diagnose and monitor the person is subjective. We use interviews, we use questionnaire, we ask. If we talk about attention, then it's usually kids. We ask the parents to fill up a questionnaire. We ask the teacher to fill a questionnaire. The professional, the psychiatrist or neurologist, talk to the kid, talk to the parents, but they don't have a really physiological measurement. Mm-hmm. And we come and we say, attention is a physiological trait. Let's treat it as one and let's measure it as one. So we give this physician a physiological measurement he didn't have before. And it gives him another data, another objective, because what we're measuring is reflex. You can't manipulate it. It's totally physiological and totally objective. And it gives something new in your diagnosis process and in the monitoring, in your day-to-day monitoring. Now, when we talk about attention, this problem is not only in the ADHD field, which is a huge problem in ADHD. I'm not even trying to say it's not a huge problem, because it is. Like 10% of the population are, this is an estimation about how many people affected by ADHD. And there is so much data about the fact that when people have ADHD and are not treated correctly or not treated at all, it affects their whole lifespan. It will affect the way they'll go into the workplace, their ability to hold work, their substance abuse, their depression, suicide rate, being able to be in a relationship, raising a family. It affects so many aspects of the life. So being able to diagnose correctly and treat correctly and monitor is huge, huge tasks that are not done. They're done with the subjective tools today. But more than this, if I'm able to measure your attention level, I can give answers in other places that attention is important. Places like professions that are high risk, high attention, like combat pilots, like surgeons, like drivers that drive from professional drivers from one side of the continent to the other. being able to accurately measure your attention level at a certain time will change the way we are talking about work safety, heavy machinery operators, and also lifestyle and professions like athletes that needs to know, it's like a biomarker that telling you when is my best attention levels, how can I get there, how can I measure them. So there is so much to do only with the ability to measure your attention.
Okay.
Add to that the ability to measure other mental health and probably a neurological disorder, it can make a huge difference in the way we measure and we understand our mental health issues.
Yeah, that's great. I had the privilege of testing out your device at this convention in Jerusalem that we both attended, where we met.
Yeah.
From what I remember, there were two parts to it. There was the audio part, which I guess you stimulate the person being tested and they hear sounds. And then there's the sensors that are placed on his face in various places under his eye. And those test if a person blinks and the like. So maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, so basically what we do, we developed a device. We have two patents on this device, on the system. We develop both device and algorithms. So basically what we do, this device do two things. The first thing it does, it apply the stimuli. So what I measure, I know it's correlated to the stimuli I gave you. So you put on headphones like you did in the Mexican convention. You put up the headphones and you hear sounds. Now it's 5 minutes test. You hear different sounds. The sounds are supposed to make you react. The reaction we are looking for is your blink reflex, because what's happened is when you hear a loud and unexpected sound, your brainstem decide this is
danger
coming. So the first thing will happen, and we're talking about 32 milliseconds from the time you heard the sound to the time your brainstem say react. The first thing that will happen is that you'll blink. You will protect your eyesight. So it's just a blink. You close your eyes and you reopen it. So if there is, I don't know, let's talk when this was developed with our evolution. So let's say the common dangers were involving trees falling, fire, animal running. So a lot of dust, a lot of hazards in the air. So you blink, you close your eyes to protect your sight, and then you immediately reopen them to see where the danger is coming from.
Right.
And we all know it. If there is a loud sound, we blink. It's reflexive. You can't really do anything about it. It just happens. And it is part of our fight, flight, or freeze system. It's very lizard brain, very, very low in the evolutionary path. Everyone have it.
Mm-hmm.
So I give you the sounds that are designed to make you blink, make your brainstem react. Very early reflexive reaction. The other thing I do, as I said, I measure the blink. What I do now, I put two electrodes under your eye on your orbicular muscle, and I measure your blink. How fast did you blink? How long? How strong? Did you close the whole? The two eyelids were totally closed or maybe just half closed. So I'm taking all this data about the blink, not just the fact that you blinked, but how. And what we're working on, and I said before that we're thinking that in the future we'll get out of the clinic and into home monitoring maybe. So we're working on getting the same data about your blink, not with the EMG electrode, but with camera. So this is future.
See.
With, you know, like image processing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we're already working on. So you'll have one device in the clinic that will give you EMG very, very precise data. And you can also do it, we'll be able to do it from home, from your cell phone, with your camera, at home, with your own headphones.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that data can use either for you as a monitoring and getting your biomarkers, or go straight to your doctor, which decide if you need to amend your medication, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these two use cases for the same technology. And as I said before, the first user is clinicians. Now, in Israel, we have more than 15% of the kids diagnosed with ADHD, which is a lot because the world is about 10%. So we have a little bit of overdiagnosis here in Israel. Places like France, for example, have 5%. So they are underdiagnosed because parents there are not trusting the system. They say, it doesn't matter what I'm saying because they don't really know how to diagnose. They'll just medicate my kids anyway. So I don't want to even go and try. We'll try to manage otherwise. So they have all this problem with that appear later on with untreated ADHD.
Also, there's a stigma, I guess, involved with
treatment.
Yeah,
so sometimes some people, the stigma is worse. ADHD, remarkably, is one of the most overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed at the same time syndromes. So it depends on what country you are. And even in a place, in a territory, it depends if you're high or low socioeconomic, because your socioeconomic will affect if you'll be diagnosed for ADHD or not. Not because you're different, because it's expensive. It's time consuming, and people from low socioeconomic more often than not won't even take their kids to psychiatrist. Sometimes you have to wait 6 months for an appointment.
Right.
It costs a lot of money. It takes time. They don't do it. In the US and in Europe, the market is remarkably different than in Israel. In Israel, most people, most kids that are diagnosed for ADHD are diagnosed by either a psychiatrist or neurologist. Most of them, or a pediatrician that went through specific training to diagnose ADHD. In the US, 85% of the kids that are diagnosed for ADHD are diagnosed by their pediatrician or a family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Just regular pediatrician, family doctor, no special training needed.
Interesting.
And these doctors, they are not psychiatrists. They are used to get kids in 10 minutes, do blood tests, do throat culture, look at their ears, send them out for x-ray or something, and send them on their way. They used to make diagnosis using physiological tool, blood test, blood pressure, x-rays. They are not used to sit 45 or 50 minutes with a patient and talking to them. This is not the way they do medicine. They have a waiting room full of kids with headaches and stomach ache and diarrhea. I mean,
right.
And they get this ADHD kids as well. So this population, because psychiatrists sometimes say, well, the tools we have are subjective and they're not perfect, but we're doing it so much we know how to diagnose.
Yeah.
We know how to treat. We're not sure we need another tool. It's nice to have because it's physiological, but I know what I'm doing. But the pediatrician or the family doctor, not necessarily, and he's more used to rely on physiological tests in his diagnosis. So for these professionals, this is a huge change, and this is something they are long looking for. And they were looking for because there are all these computerized tests out there, like Tova and Moxo and Cubitech and a bunch of them. And here in Israel, 95% of the kids that undergo ADHD diagnosis will go one of these computerized tests. In the US, less than 10%. They don't trust them. They feel they are subjective and not accurate enough. In a way, they write. This test they changed the way we think. They said we need to do something that is more objective. We need to relay less about questionnaire and more about testing. And this is just changing the paradigm. And it's really, really important. But the way they do it, again, has some inherent subjectivity in it. Because they ask you a question and you need to look at the screen, understand what you were told. So I'm also measuring your ability to understand what I'm telling you to do and not just your attention.
Right.
So it's a bit of a cognitive test in a way. And you need to look at the screen, see a little square go up and down. And when it's down, you need to decide this is what I was told to do and make a decision and press a button. So it's very complex neurologically. And it's prone to mistakes. And also, let's say you're a student and you really want Ritalin because someone told you it will help you with your test. So you saw the little square go down, but you didn't press.
I see. So you can mess with the test.
You can manipulate again. Now, the test will usually, if you do it a lot of time, it will say the person wasn't cooperating. Mm-hmm. It won't say your attention is bad. It will pick up on it. But again, I need your voluntary cooperation to give you a result.
Yeah.
It's not completely physiological. My test, because I test reflexive response, I don't need your cooperation. Mm-hmm. Your brainstem will do the work if you want it or not.
You can't tamper with it.
No,
so that's
it's a reflex.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds very interesting. Can you tell me about how the idea was born and how you personally became involved in it?
I have two wonderful partners in this. The CEO of the company, Zev Brand, and the co-founder, Professor Avi Avital. And they actually met at the Technion. Zeev was, before he came to the Technion to complete his PhD, he was working a lot on autonomous cars and robotics for military use, etc. And this was his field, robotics, autonomics, and etc. He was making robots for the army, and we had one of our never-ending wars in the area, Tsuk Eitan. And his robots in the tunnels didn't perform as well as he hoped they will. So he came out of this from Tsuk Eitan, and he said, we need to do something different. We need a better solution. And he had this idea that if he takes an organic brain, an animal brain, and instead of trying to write the robot brain, he uses something that already exists, an organic brain, and do a good job, it might help. So he was thinking about attaching a rat to the robot. So the rat will be driving the robot in a way.
Interesting.
Because, you know, when a robot get to a pile of dirt, doesn't always know how to tackle it and how to go over it, so it's stuck. But a rat, she runs in a tunnel, she see a pile of dirt, she looks to the right, she looks to the left, and she decides if she goes this way, or up, and she's over it.
Right.
She can tackle it in microseconds, like we do. It's something organic brain knows how to automatically do. So he said, let's have a rat driving our robot. Let's use the benefits of an organic mind. So he went back to the Technion with this idea in his mind to do his PhD. And they start building all these crazy cyborgs. And they got some result. And in some point, they read the rat mind with all these probes that they implant probe in the rat's brain, and they read its mind, and they start to understand that what they get their attention level. They see if the rat is like attentive or scattered.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings them together with Professor Avital, which was the head of the behavioral lab at the Technion at the time. Now he's in Haifa University, still head of the behavioral lab. And he was doing 12 years of research about attention, human attention. So the result from Zev work and Avi work kind of clicked.
Right. Interesting. Even though they're from totally different fields.
Yeah. And they start, you know, working on the idea that we can measure attention. And if we measure attention, as I said before, it can change so many fields and change the world. And they build the basic idea, the basic system idea, and they leave the Technion and establish MindTech.
I see.
And at this point, I'm doing something completely different in a different field, diagnostic, home diagnostic company. And we have a mutual friend, mentor, one of the investors in the other project that I'm working on, decide to invest in Zev's and Avi's project company. And she said, I want you to meet just to have a talk about how you start a company, what you're doing, how do you even tackle such a thing? Because I just went through the same thing with a different company. So we're meeting, having really click immediately. I think what they're doing is mind-blowing. And then we go our separate ways. A few months later, with COVID, my other project is determined. And we decide not to go on with it. And I'm doing other things. I'm doing mentoring. I'm doing lecturing. I'm doing other things. And our friend, our mentor, she contacted me and she say, will you be interesting to join Zev? He's doing it alone right now because he's running the company. Avi is still in the academy. And I say, you know what? Let's talk. And we talk and we immediately, like, we think similar. We find that we are passionate about the same things. We see the way the business need to grow in a similar way. And we decide to continue together. And I joined the company and co-founder.
And how do you decide on the division between you and Zev?
So each of us has his own strength. When we talk about developing the algorithm, about the mechanic of the device, I mean, this is not my strength. I know nothing about computers, mechanic, algorithm. I have a PhD in molecular biology. I know my biology, but I'm not a tech person.
Right.
And he's very much an algorithm and mathematic and tech person. So what we're doing is tech and technology and algorithm, but we're dealing with biology, with the human brain.
Mm-hmm. Inputs and outputs are all biological.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the way what you put in and how you interpret what you get out. So we kind of complementary strengths. So each of us has a different field he's looking into. And there's a lot of overlapping, a lot of the things we're doing together, like raising money is both of our commitment and task. We're both doing it. But if I'm dealing with the patents, because the patents are due both on the biology and the technology. So I'm dealing more with the patents, with the litigation, and with the clinical side of things. He's dealing more with the standards and algorithm and hardware and software development. So we're completing each other, and it's really good.
You had mentioned investment. Can you talk a little bit about where your investment came from?
We were very lucky. We have great, 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 wonderful group of people believing in us and putting their money where their mouth is, you know, believing in us in heart and wallet. We started out with two angel investors, family office, and another one is a company that also help us develop the device itself. It's a company that do a lot of devices for the defense and worlds, but also medical world. Mm-hmm. So we work, they knew that from his robots times.
Right.
And they are developing the device with us, and they're just wonderful. And they also invested in the company. Uh-huh. So we had a family office here from Jerusalem and another company investing in us. And we got funded by the Israeli Innovation Authority. Mm-hmm. We already have 3 years of funding from the Innovation Authority, which mm-hmm. is very, very nice to have their support. It's good that they support us. It's just showing us that what we have really have, it's matter. It's really, the government also see that it can make a change. It can make a difference. And then a year ago, we had another group of angel investors coming in. It's a group of American investors. Mm-hmm. Jewish American investors, three that came as a group and invest in the company. So we have basically four angel investors and the Israeli Innovation Authority. And we are now starting our round A because we did so much with the seed round that we raised. We have a fully operational and developed device. We have a fully operational developed algorithm for ADHD. We have a proof of concept for other algorithm and other application of our technology. We have two patents. One is pending, but the other is already granted. Mm-hmm. We have a relationship with leaders in the field. So we did so much with the money we already raised. And right now we're starting our round A. And what we'll do with this money once we get it, and I hope we'll get it soon, we'll start to go out to market. We're in the middle of our FDA approval process because mm-hmm. medical device has regulation that it needs to be compliance with. So we are in compliance with different standards needed already. We are in the middle of the FDA approval process and we're getting ready to go to market. And we're already working on it by getting in touch with key opinion leaders that are part of the community that's going to use our device. We presented in conferences, got very good response, and we'll use these funds to do three things, basically. The first is to go to finish the regulation process and go to market. The second is to grow our portfolio, more algorithm for mental health, for work safety, for human performance. And the third is to take us also out of the clinic and into the workplace and home by using camera instead of EMG. So we mm-hmm. have a track that we see, we know where we're going, and we're looking for the fund to do it now.
Okay, wow, sounds impressive. In terms of your business strategy and patents, you had mentioned two patents. How important is your IP for your business strategy?
I think IP is crucial. It gives you two things. It gives you peace of mind and freedom that you can do what you do. And even if there's other things in, you know, red ocean and other people do other things, they don't do exactly what you do. You have some kind of your mark, your fingerprint. You're unique in a way, right? Because you have a patent. No one else doing exactly the same. So this gives you this, and this is important, I think, for investors, for customers to know that you're really unique, as you say. Mm-hmm. And patent in a way say, yeah, it's unique. There's nothing else like it. Otherwise, I wouldn't grant you the patent.
Right.
And the other thing also, sometimes you need a patent, not so you can do something as much as you don't want others to do it. It's have importance. I think it's more important to do good work and give good data. But it's important to be unique and be protected. So it's have its importance, yeah.
So you had mentioned that your idea came somewhat is related to the defense industry, right? That there's some connection between defense industry and your healthcare idea. So I understand that being in Israel and a strong defense industry here has assisted you in that regard. But you are uniquely located in the Gaza envelope area. The area right near the Gaza Strip, which unfortunately now is seeing some difficult times. How does that impact you, your company, the development of your product?
I'll start with saying that up until 5 months ago, if you'd ask me this question.
So that's before October 7th, 2023,
yeah,
for our listeners.
Yeah, I would say this is the best place in the world to work in and to do innovation in.
Wow.
First of all, I don't know if you've been there. Our office was, still is, we're not in it, but it still is, in a kibbutz Nir Am. And just getting there, it's beautiful and it's so relaxed. It puts you, just being there, open your mind and makes you like so relaxed that all these ideas are just floating independently. So just, it's really, and the project, the innovation center that they build there, it was Ofir Lipshtein. He was the head of the regional council there. He died at October 7, the first 2 hours.
Hmm.
He lived in Kibbutz Kfar Aza, and he was part of their defense.
Emergency
response team. Yeah. And he was killed with his son in the first 2 hours. But bringing innovation to the South, to Gaza envelope, was his dream, his mm-hmm. idea, his vision. And he built an innovation center that is unbelievable. If you've never been there, go. 250 companies. And
wow.
And like amazing, amazing, amazing place that is really helping this company to thrive. Gives you all the facilities in a heaven-like scenery. Our employees are from the area, so there's a lot of people in the area that can do really good high-tech and biotech and computer science. Usually they will drive an hour and a half to the center of Israel. Mm-hmm. Bringing the company in and placing it there made their life easier, and so you get really, really good people with really, really high skills that really love coming to work.
Mm-hmm.
They don't drive so many hours. They're balancing their work and personal life better. So it was really, really great. Right now, it's hard. October 7 kind of made everything harder. We are out of the office since, so we're working from home. We're meeting at our partners. They are nice and helpful, and they give us the use of their conference room. Mm-hmm. So we're meeting with and other companies' conference room. We're meeting at homes. You know, our regulatory director last week, she came from Magal to stay at my house, and we just had a day of working in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll do it in Zeev, my partner's living room. Or we'll just meet wherever we can. Or we work from home, each one in his own little corner, try to get as much as we can by Zoom and emails. And for the first month and a half, we were unable to get a lot done, but we were working very hard, and we did get, after October 7, if you talk to me, October 14, I said, I don't know how we're going to do anything. We're a company of 6 people. So 2 of us were evacuated because they were living in kibbutz that were hit really hard, living through 24 hours of hell. And we didn't know how they're going to, we didn't know if they're going to live. during October 7th. Right. So just the fact that they are both alive and their families are alive is a miracle that we're grateful for. But we didn't know what will be their mental status, if they will even be able to work. We did know they're going to be refugees. They didn't right. even know where they're going to be. Another two were drafted immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So they went immediately into the army.
Like a lot of Israeli population in the, in the industry.
Exactly. So out of six, we were four out and we needed to get things started. We had hard deadlines. We got a email from the American Patent Office. They needed our response and they gave us a deadline. You need to respond in 2 weeks or your right. patent is lost. They don't care. There's a war here. So we kind of took a really hard, deep breath and we did it. And we accomplished some amazing things that I didn't believe it. But in the 3 months post October 7, we got... We finished our test for the 6601 medical device standard. We answered every patent question. We made some new relationship with prospect customers and affiliations. And so we got so much done and it was amazing. It was like, despite, it was like we knew we were in a trouble and we decided we're not going to let it make us fall. So I, if you ask me how we did it, I don't know. I'm just taking my head down to my team, but it was amazing, really.
Wow. So it sounds like you have tremendous perseverance, especially considering even now some of your employees, I understand, are
yeah.
not back at home yet.
No, two of them, two out of six, still evacuated, still not home. And we don't know when they're going to be home.
Mm-hmm.
The offices are still closed, so we're still working from home. But we kind of got our rhythm back. Mm-hmm. We kind of got, you know, someone asked me, I think it was in end of November, how are you? So I said, you know what? I'm getting used to the new normal. I don't really like it. I would like to go back to the old normal, but I'm getting used to the new normal and this is our normal now.
What tips do you have for founders who are just starting with a new idea or with a new company?
This is important. First of all, know your market. Even if you have like the best idea ever and you say, no one ever did it. How come no one ever thought about it? This is great. This is amazing. It will change the world. Know your market. Before you go talk to anyone about it, do some Google search, but you know, go deep and check. First of all, if there is really nothing like it. Even if there's nothing like it, but if there is some solution to the problem you're trying to solve and it's good enough, sometimes even if your solution is just a little better and not a lot better, it will have a hard time because people are used to something and if it's good enough for them, it will be hard to convince them to change.
Right.
So if there's nothing like it or if you're making a big difference, then look if you have a market and then start talking to people in this industry. Try to get what they think. Try to see if what you think is a problem is a real problem for them or not. And mm-hmm. listen. Try to listen more than you talk. And this is hard. You know, I know because I love talking, but it's hard. But try to listen to your future customers, to your future relationship and partners. Try to really understand their view and understand the market you're going to talk to. And then when you know that your idea is really making a difference and it's good and that you really have a market, just then try to pitch it out.
Okay, those are important tips. Let's just ask you one last question. A lot of my guests on the show have been male founders and you're a female founder. So tell me, how is that impacting the company? Is that difficult?
This is a hard one, you know, because from one hand, I want to say you see more and more female founders nowadays than you saw 5 or 10 years ago. I think founders need to be measured upon how good they are and how driven they are and how good their ideas are and less what gender they are. But unfortunately, this is not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're a good female founder that did it, everyone will give you as an example. But the fact of the matter is that you have less female founders. You can't go around the bushes. This is the numbers. And I did have a feeling sometimes that there are investors that kind of looking for the male person in the company. Like they still feel, some of the investors still feel that if there is no male founder or they will look for it. Who are you working with? There are questions that women get asked and men don't, especially about work balance. Like there's a bigger concern for some people that women will prioritize differently in a way that they think is wrong. I'm not sure it's true. And I think the world is starting to change. It's not there yet. And as we see more and more example of female entrepreneurs that are successful, I think it will become easier for the next generation of female entrepreneurs. Another thing is also the femtech. Everyone say femtech. Like you have healthcare and you have femtech, like two different issues. Right. Well, femtech cover the health of half of the population, guys. So, you know, and a lot. And actually, this is something that it didn't start with the high tech or biotech industry. I had 10 years in the academia before, 15 years in the academia, but let's just talk about the last 10. You see it in medication development. All of the mice, when I did my research about cancer and diabetic, they always were male mice. Mm-hmm. It's easier to work with male mice. So the drug we developed were more compatible with males. And we see it with heart drugs and diabetic drugs and some kind of cancer drugs, chemotherapy. They are more compatible and they work better on males than females. So
interesting.
It's not only in high tech. It's a way, in a way, it's all over. It affects all of our lives. But I think it's something that starts to change. And it's a good change. I bless.
It was great hearing from you, Dr. Hadas Shatz Azulai, about the change that you guys are trying to bring to the world. I'm encouraged. And even going through these difficult times, this gives a lot of encouragement to me and hopefully to our listeners as well. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Hadas Shatz Azulai, the co-founder of MindTension. We hope you enjoyed this episode. There are many more to come. Do you have a great innovation or startup idea? We'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us by going to our website, jmbdavis.com. And if you go to jmbdavis.com/startup, you'll see we have a special site specifically made for startups to help startups protect their innovations. Please be in touch with us and find out how we can help you. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to bringing you the next episode.